Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So welcome again to Nate and Kaylee Klemp. Those of you who are in the room can use the Q&A function for any questions for the presenters. And here we go.
You ready for us? Can we share our screen?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, before we put our slides up, we just want to say hello while we are nice and large on your screen. Thank you so much for joining us for this exploration of marriage and radical generosity.
Yeah, it's so great to be here. And we're excited to share this content with you.
Mm-hmm. So here we go.
So we thought, given that this is a topic about relationships and marriage, that we wanted to give you a little bit of context for how we arrived at this. And I guess that really starts with a little bit of context about how we arrived at this. And so we wanted to share just a little bit about our story. So we have two pictures here. These are from the spring of 1997. So that's about 23 years ago. And this is us in high school. So we actually both grew up in Boulder, Colorado, which is where we still live today. We met at Boulder High School. We were in chemistry class. And we were stationed at the same lab table. And I saw this girl at that time across from me and, you know, thought she was interesting. We started doing these study dates together. And what you'll see here is the first picture is me asking Kaylee, will you go to prom with me? And the second is the two of us at prom. So this is our 17-year-old selves.
And we don't like to read too much into the prom picture about, you know, who would end up carrying who through the rest of the relationship. Mostly that was just a game to play. But then we like to have, do you want to say more about Princeton?
Well, so that's the beginning of the story. The second part of the story is that we ultimately, it didn't last. We ended up going to college, actually the same college, but about a month before we decided, you know, we're 17, we're too young. Let's just see what happens if we break up. Maybe we'll get back together again if it was meant to be. And so we were friends for many years. And then about 7 years later, when we were separated on each coast of the United States, I was in New Jersey, she was in San Francisco. At about 24, we decided to get back together. And then ultimately we got married. That was about 15 years ago. So the reason we wanted to start with that story is, you know, a lot of our friends tell us, oh my gosh, that's like such a fairy tale. It's amazing, right? But what that story misses are the years, especially right after we got married, where we felt like we had no clue what we were doing. We were constantly in conflict. And really, there were a couple points at which we almost lost our marriage. And I think that's probably true of most relationships, that we see this glossy veneer on the outside, especially with social media. But the reality is that all of us can really struggle at various points along the road. So that was sort of the beginning. And then
So then more recently, about 2 years ago, Nate and I were out on a hike, which we do as our ritual. It's our date hike rather than our date night.
That's right.
And we were talking about marriage, one of our favorite subjects. And what we were talking about is it was so hard. And that we were looking at our parents. We said, gosh, they're great. But the way that they did marriage doesn't really work for us. And then we were reflecting that in conversations with our friends, no one seemed to have this surefire way to do it. Everyone was really struggling with how to make it work. How do we stay equals? How do we stay partners? How do we stay intimately in love? And so we thought, surely someone's written a book about this. And then we went looking and we found phenomenal books about some of the psychology of marriage, attachment theory, and some of the psychological trauma. And we thought, that's part of the story. And then we found some other books that were about some of the structure. So they would have things like who should do which chore and how do you divide the labor fairly? And that was part of the story, but no one had brought it together and no one had looked at relationships in the context of our modern lives, of being together in this crazy environment. And back then we weren't even in the crazier environment of coronavirus. And we said, how do you bring these together? Mindset, structure, and the context of modern life into a model for marriage that fits for us.
Yeah, so we're gonna be talking more about that model and exploring that with you. But before we get into that, we've given you a little bit of context about us, but we would love to learn a little bit more about you. So we have a Zoom poll that we want to start with. And the question here is, how often do you feel disconnected, resentful, or out of step with your partner? So one option is never. We live in a state constant of constant bliss. Maybe once in the last month, every week, every day. And then finally, are you kidding? I feel this all the time. I'm probably feeling this right now while I'm on this call.
Votes are coming in. Every week is the current front runner.
Biasing the sample.
Am I biasing the sample? Yes. Is that cheating?
Yes.
Really?
That's why they don't announce results.
I thought they report results all the time. Kaylee's vote just came in. She was saying every week. All right.
All right, we got a few more coming in.
5 more seconds for final votes.
Great. Okay, so the results should be posted. So we don't have anybody living in a state of constant bliss, which is good. We were going to tell you to actually end the call and maybe do your own workshop after this for the rest of us. But what we see is the most common pattern here is every week, which feels about right. Every week, there's one of these conflicts. Some of you said once in the last month. Others are saying, look, I'm feeling this way all the time,
right,
which is totally understandable.
Hopefully by the end of this, we'll give you a few tools. Go into the weekend well.
Absolutely.
All right. So, want to give you a little bit of background on how we got here. So we have our story, but then there's also the context. So before we talk about 80-80, which is the subject of our book, we want to give you some background. The initial way that marriage was done was what we call 80-20, which we think timestamped somewhere around the 1950s. And in this period of time, one of the partners, usually the woman, took about 80% of the responsibility for the well-being of the marriage. And the other partner, usually the man, took about 20% for the well-being of the marriage. And in some ways, when you look at this, you go, wow, that was wildly unfair, which was true. And out of the other side of our mouth, you could say there was at least some redeeming quality, which was these two partners knew their jobs. There wasn't confusion about who was supposed to be doing what. But that also led to a lot of rigidity that one person would say, hey, my job is to go to the office. My job is to make the money. And the other person would say, that is not my job. Meanwhile, the other partner might say, I'm raising our family. But if I needed help in a moment to change a diaper for instance, the other partner would be like, oh no, that is not my job. And so this mindset that it's not my job led to this pattern of deference and control. Now, I don't know, when was the last time I greeted you at the door with a martini and a massage?
That has never happened.
Never, not once. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, so if you want to try that.
And we could experiment.
Yeah. So that's the first model of marriage, this 80-20 sort of classical archetype. And for many of us, this is the model of our grandparents. This might even be the model of our parents. For us, our parents are kind of in this in-between zone. But when we look at our generation and this new generation of couples, what we see is a fundamental shift to a very different model, which is what we call the 50-50 model of marriage. And this is a model that's based on an assumption that's now almost universal. So there's actually a Pew poll that found something like 97% of the industrialized world agrees that with this basic assumption of equality in marriage, yeah, that we should be equals when it comes to marriage. Now, of course, that's what we say about equality in marriage. That's often not what we do. The same research shows that men tend to do far less, you know, statistically, than women, and that women carry more of the emotional labor. But the basic idea here is that we've shifted to a radically different model where the basic assumption is that no one is supposed to be supporting the other. We are equals. And that is, as Kaylee mentioned, that's a huge leap forward. I mean, this is good for all sorts of reasons. The problem is that what's emerged with this model of 50-50 marriage is a new mindset that's based on this idea of fairness. Because the fundamental question that arises in this new model is, okay, so now we're equals and we're both equally capable of going out in the world and kicking ass and getting a great job, but we're also both equally capable of doing the dishes, changing diapers. So who does what? Who's supposed to change the diapers? Who's supposed to take our daughter to school? Right? We don't really have a good way to answer these questions. And so the mindset of this model has become a mindset inherited from government and politics, which is this mindset of fairness. If we just make everything perfectly fair, we think,
50-50,
then we'll live in marital bliss, like those people who, well, I guess we didn't have any on the call. So that's the basic idea of the 50-50 marriage. And we're going to get into some of the problems with this mindset of fairness. But first, we wanted to just kind of unpack the idea of fairness. And the way we wanted to do that is to share with you. So in the process of writing this book and in this project, we interviewed about 100 couples from all walks of life. And what we found is that most couples said some version of figuring out what is fair, who's doing more, who's contributing more, who cares more, is the fundamental challenge of modern marriage that they experienced. And these are just a few of the quotes that came out of those interviews. So people talking about this fairness mindset, it's tit for tat, quid pro quo, keeping score. One of my favorites here is we had a woman who said, we become accountants when things feel unfair. We start to have a ledger of everything she did, everything I did. And the result is this real sort of lack of connection, lack of love. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But these are just a few of the sort of reflections from our interviews about what this idea of fairness feels like, what it sounds like.
And so our second Zoom poll, we would love to hear from you. Is this something that you ever experience? Do you and your partner ever argue about fairness? Who's doing more? Who cares more? Who's trying harder? And on our poll, what we'll say is, you could say, we're arguing about this right now, or all the time, maybe once a week or so, or we rarely even think about it. Fairness? Never been an issue for us. Not once.
Those are the marital bliss people.
Those are the marital bliss people. They're not on our call.
They don't show up to this.
That's because I'm not sure they exist. They're like leprechauns.
They are. Like the Fred and Wilma Flintstones. Was that their name?
Who rode the car with their
feet? Yeah, they were like the perfect couple.
Interesting. Yeah. Cave people. That's where we're going for our models.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. All right. We'll give this about 5 more seconds. Perfect. All right. So with people reporting in, same sort of frequency that about once a week, right, in that same spot where we're feeling disconnected to our partners is where we're recognizing this tension around fairness, which validates a lot of what we heard from the people that we interviewed, that when you get caught in this question around what's fair, it very often leads to disconnection and resentment.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody, for sharing. So what we wanted to do now is talk about some of the ways in which this shows up, this pattern of fairness. Because fairness in the abstract, it's this like big abstract concept. But we found it helpful to show in practice, in the concrete moment-to-moment flow of everyday life, what this starts to look like. And so in the book, we talk about a number of different ways this shows up, but today we just want to talk about four. So the first is what we call the domestic scorekeeping fight. And this is kind of like the classic fairness fight that emerges in many couples. So this is when I go up to Kaylee and I say, you know, Kaylee, I have done the dishes like three nights in a row.
Oh,
that is on you tonight.
Oh,
I'm going to cook a huge meal and I am not touching a dish.
So when I cook and you clean, that's not fair. And so when you cook, you're just going to make big messes.
I'm just saying I did it three nights in a row.
So when I was doing the laundry for approximately the last 15 years.
Yeah, and I took our daughter to school.
I mean, once.
You get the feel for that one.
So the next fight is really around friends and extended family and trying again to make that feel equal, to make it feel 50-50. So we should spend exactly the same amount of time with both sets of parents, which means we did Thanksgiving with your family last year, so it's definitely my family's turn.
Well, but we spent like 3 days after the holiday with your family.
Yeah, so but that's because you got Christmas Day. There should definitely be like a bonus day.
Well, they got the bonus days. They got the 3 days. So we got 2 days. You got one extra day.
But what about Father's Day? You didn't count Father's Day. We did your
Father. We did Mother's Day. And my, you get the feel for that one. So another way this shows up for a lot of couples is around money. And not surprisingly, money is one of the most explosive areas of marriage and relationships. And the money fight might look something like this. You know, Kaylee, I spent $30 on an Old Navy sweatshirt for my dad for Father's Day. Mm-hmm. And you went off and spent $500 on this like tournament grade ping pong table.
It was a birthday that ended in a zero. And by the way, that never happened. But the Amazon boxes that show up on our porch every day, addressed to you, my friend, what are you spending that on?
So you get the feel for that one.
And so then finally, we have the free time fight. And this is really about trying to make sure that each person in the relationship gets exactly the same amount of leisure time. So as you can see here, it could be, you know, you went to Target for an hour, and so it's my turn to go for a run. But one of my favorites is, you got to work out 3 days in a row, and so I think I should get a half day off.
Of doing anything? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I think like couch.
I was up at 5:30 in the morning working out.
Just because you work out in like the wee hours of the night doesn't mean that everyone should.
And one thing I would just say about this free time fight, this we have found and we have heard from the people we interviewed, it emerges on day one when you have a kid. So, you know, for us, the day we had a child, free time became like domestic gold. It was the most scarce resource in all of marriage.
And I'm seeing that Justin Holland, you're accentuating this point that sometimes this fight about fairness shows up, especially with young kids, where there is no leaving them to play Legos, but they require attention all the time.
Totally.
That 5 minutes where you can actually complete a thought on the phone with a friend becomes so precious. And so what we'd like to invite you to do is just take a few moments to write down, how does fairness show up in your relationship? It might be one of the four flavors that we outlined here, but it might be one of your own unique flavors of fairness and how it manifests in your relationship. And the reason that we ask you to do this is because, one, very often fairness lives in our blind spot, that we don't even know that that's at the root of an argument or a struggle. And by framing it this way, you give yourself access to a number of tools that just aren't available if you're thinking about it without this frame of fairness. We also invite you to write it down because something about putting it on paper makes it tangible enough that you can make some different choices. So with that, we're going to pause just for a moment and allow you to reflect and write down, how does fairness show up in your relationship? I know that I'm in a mindfulness community when I see people grab legit pens and paper and journals. I just love that. And if you have finished writing, we would love to see in the Q&A just a couple different ways that fairness shows up in various relationships. Really identify with doing everything and then feeling resentful. Definitely measuring contributions. That's perfect.
Ranking actions.
Oh, completely.
That's great.
Ready? All right.
Okay, great. So we invite you to finish whatever that last thought is. Hopefully that's helpful, a way of just making explicit some of these ways in which fairness shows up for you. So now we want to talk a little bit more about the problem of fairness. We've talked about how it shows up. You've done your own exploration about how this might show up for you in your relationship. But one of the things we spent a lot of time thinking about in this project is, why doesn't fairness work? Like, what is the problem here with fairness? And we thought about this both in relation to our own marriage, the people we interviewed, but also it turns out there's a pretty extensive literature in the field of psychology around some of the problems that arise when we try to make these kind of calculations about what is or isn't fair. So the first problem that comes up,
gotcha.
Problem one, we'll call it, is that fairness doesn't actually exist. We think it does. And especially during those early years of marriage or the early times in a relationship, it seems like there should be this thing like fairness. And we often think about it as almost like a mirage in the desert. It looks like the water is really there. And if you just go far enough, you're gonna get there. But every time you move forward and think you're getting closer to it, it recedes into the background. And the same is true of fairness, right? This idea that we can make things perfectly fair turns out to be almost non-existent, this vacuous concept. And one of the reasons for this comes out of cognitive psychology. It's a phenomenon that psychologists call availability bias. And this is basically just a fancy way of saying that when it comes to our contributions to the marriage, I have a perfect data set of everything that I do. So I can see that this morning I made the bacon for our child. I helped her get her lunch into her backpack. I can see that I put our child to bed last night, that I was the one who did the finances, right? So my window into my own world of contribution is perfect. And yet, when it comes to her contributions,
he has no idea that I'm the one who spent an hour with each family member trying to organize a COVID-safe and somehow structured Thanksgiving where everyone got to eat gluten-free and dairy-free and that there was a vegetarian option, right? This also gets accentuated not only by the availability bias that I know what I'm doing and don't really know what he's doing, and he knows what he's doing, but not what I'm doing, but also that many of these contributions are invisible, particularly in the realm of emotional labor. So maybe the hour on the phone with each family member could be seen and measured, but then the hours that I spend thinking about the menu or how to reach out to people or how to make sure that we avoid that conflict that somehow always seems to show up right around the holidays, all of that caring, all of that attention, that emotional labor, as it's called, is invisible.
Exactly. So that's the first problem. But let's imagine for a sec that we could somehow solve that problem, that I could get perfect insight into everything Kaylee did. She could get perfect insight into everything we did. And we could come up with this perfect tally of who did what and make things fair. Well, the problem is there's actually an additional concern or an additional phenomenon that psychologists have started to see. And this is from research over the last 10 or so years, what they started to notice is that something really weird happens when it comes to our ability to estimate labor in the household. So it turns out we're actually really good at estimating how much we do at work. Like when I say I worked for 2 hours, chances are that's pretty darn close to 2 hours. When it comes to work around the house, however, because it's so intermittent and it's constantly disrupted, and there are things like doing the laundry where you work for 5 minutes, but then it takes 2 hours, our estimations are extremely bad and we tend to overestimate. And this is something that happens to both women and men, but men do it more and are fall more prone to this.
So this overestimation reminds me of the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where he was measuring how many push-ups it felt like he was doing. So it went something like 1, 5, 100, 9,000. It sort of feels like that when it comes to domestic labor, that we overestimate because it feels like it really has been 7 hours of vacuuming, even if it's only been 20 minutes.
So all this is to say is that when we look at the empirical literature here on psychology, it shows that we have no real way to adjudicate what is or isn't fair, right? Our assessments of fairness are inherently biased by what's available to us, but also by our tendency to just completely overestimate what we've actually done. So that's really the first problem with fairness, but that's not all.
No, the second problem is it doesn't work. That this attempt to adjudicate fairness ends up giving us the opposite of what we really want. So I want it to be fair. And so to do that, I keep score. I make sure that I know what I did, and then I try to keep track of what you did. And the problem is because we can't measure accurately, and because my strategy is so often that of nagging, instead what I get is resentment and withdrawal. We experienced this early in our marriage in what we like to fondly refer to as the grill problem.
The grill
problem went a little something like this. The grill was filthy. And as I had done most of the cleaning on the inside of the house, I said to Nate, "Hey, babe, would you mind cleaning the grill?" And he said,
"It's on my list, babe. I got it."
And so a week or two later, when the grill had not been touched, I went back to him and said, "So, babe, grill?
I told you it's on my list. I got it. I'm on it."
And so like a week or so later, when the grill was still filthy, I went back to him and I was like, "WTF with your list, man? What's happening with the grill?" And what had really happened in my world was that I couldn't trust him. I was so mad that my resentment was building around, fine, I'll just do it myself.
So in my world, the experience was losing all motivation to do anything, because I started to have the story that anything I do is not going to be enough. So why not just withdraw from everything, not do anything, say it's on my list? And it was really painful, even though it sounds like I was free riding and, you know, what a great life. It was painful for me. It was clearly painful for her. And I think the big point here is that, you know, we think fairness is going to have this motivating effect. And if we have a more reluctant partner, it's going to get them to do what we want them to do. But it's often the opposite.
I love Mark in the chat. He says, "Kaylee, you misread it. He was saving the grill cleaning for your Christmas present."
That's right. Thank you, Mark.
I'm good thinking, Mark. Thank I like Mark. It. Never mind that it was January. All right.
So we want to share just an example of this from outside of our relationship. This is, again, from one of the interviews we did. And this is really kind of, it shows how devastating this kind of scorekeeping habit can be. This is from a man who was talking about how fairness really ended his marriage. So he says, "There was a scorecard in my marriage. The dynamic that played out was that my wife wanted to do everything. So I stopped doing anything, which isn't my nature. I'm usually a doer. And then the story in our marriage became Chris doesn't do anything. So I just shut down and became resentful because my contribution was expected. It wasn't a gift to the marriage. It was me taking orders." And I think one of the reasons we want to highlight this again is that often there's an over-contributing and an under-contributing partner. And what I love about this quote is it shows that this pattern is just as painful often for the over-contributing partner as the under-contributing partner. There is no winner here. You know, really both people experience this with a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, and not getting what they really want out of marriage, which is more connection, intimacy, love, the things we really want.
And so recognizing that this wasn't working, we started getting curious about what other model could be possible. And that's where we landed on the 80-80 marriage, that instead of striving for 50-50, you change your mindset, where now I'm striving to contribute 80% in my marriage from a mindset of radical generosity. That instead of keeping track where, you know, gosh, my partner expects something or I expect something for doing something, there are no strings attached. That my contribution comes from that place of generosity of spirit, and not just regular generosity, radical generosity. The other thing that is possible from this space of 80-80 is instead of striving for me to win, for my success, it shifts where now the structure is that of shared success, that when I win, you win, and when you win, I win. And it completely transforms the experience. That in 80-80, the mindset and the structure come together for a whole new model that really fits this modern context of marriage.
Yeah, so we want to unpack what that means a little bit. And before we do that, I did just want to say, you know, this idea of radical generosity, it can almost seem like some sort of a pipe dream that we're peddling here. You know, just be more radically generous and everything will change, right? Or it can seem like obvious, like, yeah, just be more generous. But one of the things I like to say about this is that this is a very countercultural idea, right? In many ways, what we've been talking about with this 50-50 model is that we're wired now culturally to really look out for number one and to make sure I'm not doing any more than my 50% in marriage. And if I am, you owe me for that because I don't want to be taken advantage of, and we're equals here, right? And so this idea of striving for 80%, shooting over the 50% marker, that is a pretty wild idea.
And if we're honest, the math doesn't work. There is no such thing as 160%. And yet, if you embrace the idea, what we found is that in that extra 60%, what you get is the experience of love, intimacy, and connection that really isn't available without that stretch.
Okay, so let's unpack this idea of radical generosity, because if we were to just say, hey, take our word for it, radical generosity, it's a great idea, it's going to change your marriage, that only gets us so far. And what we've found is that ideas are great, insights are amazing, but they often don't last. You go to a conference like this, you hear some great ideas, a week or two later, we have this tendency of just falling back into our same habits and patterns. So when we think about radical generosity, we want to think about what are the tactical habits that we can begin to build into our everyday life that allow this to transform from just this interesting idea to something that's actually like embedded in the moment-to-moment flow of our everyday life. And so we want to unpack three main elements to this idea of radical generosity. And I hope you'll see that at the end, if you can build these three elements into your marriage, we're talking about some pretty fundamental transformation, or your relationship. You don't have to be married. So we'll start with the first of these elements, which is contribution. And this is kind of the essence of radical generosity. It's the idea of doing something that's radically generous, giving your partner a gift with no strings attached, and often without even the desire to get credit for it, right? Which is something that we all experience. You know, when I fill up the car with gas, I can just feel the part of me that comes home and wants to say, filled up your car with gas, babe.
Oh, thanks, babe.
Yeah, no problem. I get that little hit of appreciation. But what we're talking about here is offering a radically generous gift without the strings attached, without that seeking for approval. And, you know, there's a tendency here to think that these radically generous acts need to be something big, you know, like I need to get Kaylee concert tickets with backstage passes back
yes,
when we used to do that sort
yes,
of thing,
you do.
When we could go to concerts. Or like radical generosity means planning a trip to Fiji where we can be on vacation for 2 weeks, right?
Yes.
That would be awesome, obviously. But what we found is actually some of the most powerful acts of radical generosity are the little things, mm-hmm. right? So it might be writing a love note and putting it in her backpack for her to discover. It might be putting a post-it note on her computer with four reasons why I appreciate her. It might be unloading the dishwasher for you before you wake up.
or doing the dishes a couple of days in a row without that sort of niggling thought that's like, oh, it's your turn, but just as a radically generous gift.
And one thing I would just add here is there are times when I am doing the dishes, for example, and I start thinking, this is not fair. I've been doing way more today. And so what we use in those moments is just this simple mindset shift, just to become aware that the fairness pattern is happening, and just a small mental reminder of radical generosity. Mm-hmm. I just think to myself, radical generosity. Kaylee does the same thing. And it's amazing how just that small nudge can completely change the energy of a situation like that. So anyway, that's the first tactic, habit.
And so if contribution is what you do, then appreciation is what you see. And I think about appreciation as being the glasses that you wear in your relationship. Sometimes we think about it even as the call and response, that when a partner does something radically generous, do you notice it? And do you appreciate it? Do you even see it to be able to thank them for it? And when this cycle is working really well, it builds on itself, right? That each radically generous act then generates an appreciation that becomes contagious, where I want to give more and I want to see more. So there's when there is something different to notice, you can appreciate it. But then there's also this stretch of radical generosity, which is just wearing the glasses of appreciation throughout normal life. Almost this sentiment of, can I catch my partner doing something that I can appreciate? Can I notice something small or subtle? Can I appreciate the way that they greet my daughter when she's doing the way that you greet our daughter when she's doing her homework? Can I appreciate the way that Aunt needs are anticipated, or that invisible emotional labor and the thoughtfulness that went into it, right? Can I catch something invisible, call it out, and appreciate it? And that tone really changes the mindset of the entire relationship as a whole.
Yeah, so with these first two habits, we found that it really works well to leverage some of the science of habit formation here, because if you just say, okay, I'm going to appreciate you more, I'm going to do something radically generous, it often slips away. But like for us, at the end of each night, before we're going to bed, we've created that as our habit forming cue to offer an appreciation toward each other. And so it's become something that's almost automatic, right? So it just sort of happens every day. And we found that's the best way to build this into your day as a habit. So there's one more element to radical generosity. And I think this one's really important, because with the first two, you can start to think that radical generosity is this kind of marital utopia where, like, I just do these amazing things for you. I give you roses and then you appreciate me. And then
I ride home on my unicorn.
She rides home on her unicorn, and then she gives me amazing stuff and I appreciate her, and we ride off into the sunset happily ever after. And while that would be nice, our experience is that that's almost impossible. Nobody actually experiences that. And that inevitably, no matter how lined up and connected you are, you have these moments of misunderstanding, of disconnection, of conflict, of just frustration, feeling pissed off at each other. That's just kind of an inevitable part of this. So the last piece of radical generosity is what we call revealing. And it's basically just this idea of when you feel that disconnection, that frustration, that anger, giving as a gift to your partnership, your marriage, a clean reveal and request. So that's what we call this tool, reveal and request. And it's pretty simple. The first part of it is just to reveal your authentic emotional experience. Like, hey, you know, I felt really frustrated when you and your family planned this whole thing for your sister and I wasn't involved in it. So that would be the reveal. And then the request might be something like, hey, you know, next time when you guys plan a party like that, I'd like to be involved in the planning process.
Right. And you'll notice that when it's revealed from that place of love, with the mindset of radical generosity, where it's clear and it's clean, on the receiving end of that, very often it lands with, oh my gosh, of course. Or I'm sorry, that there can be compassion and generosity of spirit that then shows up on the other side, which is so different from how conflict often goes when you don't use a tool like reveal and request, and instead it leaks out sideways, where all of a sudden there's a passive aggressive stomach ache at the time of that birthday party. So instead, to stay in connection, and Allie named this at the beginning, often this will make our hearts beat faster. And that's where we know that this truth is something that is a gift to the relationship to ultimately bring us closer, because we know each other more.
Absolutely.
Nice. Okay. So when we do all three of these things, you end up in the virtuous cycle. So the opposite of the vicious cycle that occurs in fairness, for this one, when the goal is radical generosity, we come at things with this motive of shared success. When you win, I win. And what we get is this culture of contagious generosity, of contagious connection. And so with that, you keep finding the reveal leads to another reveal, leads to deeper connection, leads to contribution, leads to appreciation. And in this virtuous cycle, you find your closeness, your trust, and your intimacy all are enhanced.
Yeah, and one of the things we often hear is, this sounds great, but my partner would never do this. My partner would never be radically generous. And by the way, it's their turn to be radically generous. If anybody needs to start this, it's not me, it should be my partner. But what we found is that the nature of this shift to radical generosity is such that if you are able to make this shift, it does have this contagious effect that you alone have the power to change the culture of your marriage or your relationship simply by shifting your own mindset.
Yes.
That shift in your mind can shift the entire culture of marriage. It's pretty incredible. And I think it's worth testing for yourself.
Yes.
To see if that's true for you.
Absolutely. And so, whoops.
Yeah, so we wanted to give you another kind of real world example of this. This is also pulled from our interviews. So this is a very different marriage. This is a man who lives with his wife in Manhattan with a set of triplets.
Which is crazy.
Requires a lot of radical generosity. So he says, my wife and I have always tried to think, what can I do to help? And when everyone has that attitude, it becomes contagious. Even the kids see it and feel inspired by it. So that's just a really different world of marriage than the one we talked about before, the previous quote. And we just wanted to sort of highlight just how different it would be to be in these two relationships.
And I think that this speaks to one of the questions that we're seeing in the chat, which is this notion of, what if you have an over-contributing partner and an under-contributing partner? And we talk quite a bit about this in the book, because that's a pattern that does show up. And what we encourage is to get curious about, how and why are you facilitating that pattern continuing, so that you can use radical generosity as a mindset to potentially reveal, hey, I feel scared to maintain this pattern where I'm giving more. And if I start expecting more, then gosh, we end up in that vicious cycle of resentment. Can I instead give to the relationship from radical generosity and also reveal that, hey, this pattern is something that feels unsettling?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to step in with a little question that kind of brings some of the Q&As together. This could be really new information for folks who are learning embodiment practices. And when we meditate or when we do movement-based practices, we often meet with resistance.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you could address, what is this moving beyond the 50-50 mindset? And what have been some of the real learnings about getting to that 80-80? This generous spilling over from your reserves, perhaps of the love, of the commitment, of the care. What are some of the other juicy moments that you've noticed that have really helped you in your embodiment advancement?
Yeah, well, one thing I would say is, I think this idea of resistance is really important to call out, that as we were saying earlier, there's a habit or a cultural tendency to stay safe by making things fair. And when you move to this 80-80 mindset of radical generosity, one of the first things you may encounter is quite a bit of fear and discomfort. And it's almost like a feeling of going into the unknown. That's scary. And so when we talk about how this relates to mindfulness and embodiment, you know, one of the key practices here is to be able to stay in that place of discomfort, to be able to stay present there and just notice that that's your reaction, right? Because we tend to get very uncomfortable there, and our reaction to that resistance is to somehow, you know, become passive aggressive or strike out against our partner. So that would be my first thought there. And then I think Kaylee, you had a...
Well, I was going to say, I think this gets in some ways to this reflection that getting curious about that resistance and then moving through it with habits, that this isn't so much just an idea, but the way to move through it is with practice, right? That the first time you're on a yoga mat or the first time you're on a cushion, it might be exciting, but time number four, you're like, huh, this is uncomfortable. And time 25, right? There's a way that the practice actually enhances the experience. And so building it into a practice, into a habit, is a really powerful way to get it integrated. Because at first, something new requires some discipline before it then actually becomes the gift unto itself to continue doing it. And so that's actually a really beautiful transition. Thank you, Ali, to invite each one of you to write down, how will you make this real for yourself? What's a radically generous act that you could do for your partner? And again, this could be something small. And then what's something that you could actively appreciate them for? If you put on those glasses of appreciation, what could you see that perhaps previously had gone unnoticed or at least unnamed? And then finally, what's a truth that you haven't yet spoken that you could reveal from a place of radical generosity that could enhance trust and connection in your relationship?
These are beautiful questions as we wind down now toward the end of our session. And I just really hope that people will take those questions to heart and make sure that you jot them into your journals and really work on them. I want to thank our hosts, Nate and Kaylee, for their extraordinary work, both on themselves and just to bring to mind that during this time of Corona, how useful it is to begin to do conscious work like this.
Absolutely. If you want more, knowing that this was just a taste.
Yeah, we were just going to say that, in terms of the mindfulness.
Okay, so can I ask you to drop that into chat and then do that at the last minute so we can get through these other housekeeping things? Is that okay?
We've got about 30 seconds, Ali. Could we do that? And then sure, we'll all wrap together. It. Is that fine?
Sure.
Thanks.
We were just going to point everyone to Mindful Magazine, both the print version and online, for more about mindfulness and embodiment. And then everything we've shared today comes from our book, The 80-80 Marriage. So we want to just mark that. It's coming out in February. And for those who pre-order it, we are happy to give you a free subscription to one of our virtual retreats. You can just contact us. We also have a newsletter. But just want to let you know there's more on this if you want to go deeper. And we'll end there. Thank you, everyone, very much.
Thanks, Ali.
Okay, thank you. And panelists and attendees, please drop anything else into chat to offer any kind of feedback on what you thought to our host tonight. So thank you again from the Embodiment Conference and the generosity of Mark Walsh and his team. This really is an extraordinary time. Up next in the Embodiment Portal is Rick Hansen at 7 p.m. ET. And then after that, later tonight, is Martial Awareness with Rory Miller. And then Joshua Silve as the nervous system strains toward liberation, Eric Cardos, the magic of conscious kink for navigating conflict, and on it goes, the alchemy of kemetic yoga. So please check your schedule in the Embodiment Portal. Take a look at the upper right-hand corner of the Embodiment Portal for the coffee breaks. Teresa has placed that in the chat, as well as our private Facebook group. And also to remember that as we go on, that the library is available for you to purchase, and that this is a way that you could offer a great thank you to all of our volunteer presenters, as well as to the others who come after, who might want to have access to this beautiful set of 10,000 hours of presentation. So take a look at the chat. Teresa, thank you so much for co-hosting with me. And now it's time for the top tip from our hosts for embodiment.
So for embodiment in your relationship, my top tip is to have a moment of appreciation and connection at the end of each day, where you drop in and really feel your own heart and how that is connected to that of your partner.
Yeah, mine would be to simply take those three questions we ended on. What's a radically generous act? How can you appreciate your partner? What can you reveal? Take those, and the challenge for you is to turn those three things into a reality by the end of this weekend. So you have 2 days, and that should be enough time to embody those. That would be my closing tip.
So my hand goes on to my heart as I bow to you guys as we finish tonight. Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your time in this day.